From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll hear about the importance of giving law enforcement sensitivity training about people with mental illness.
Later, poet and Milwaukee native Jody Hollander talks about how her approach to writing poems has evolved.
One of the great lessons that I've learned as a poet is that you have to be willing to follow the lead of the poem.
And Wisconsin writer Sandy Brell returns with a sequel to her middle grade novel about a young girl coming of age in occupied Norway in World War II.
I was sure that Norway had been neutral the way Sweden was, or Switzerland was, and it turns out that wasn't the case at all. And their stories just were so embedded with national pride and resilience and humor. The humor particularly struck me, and I came away knowing that I'd want to write those stories.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee is among a number of cities around the nation whose police departments are putting officers through crisis intervention training. The sessions teach law enforcement how to handle difficult interactions with people who are mentally ill.
WUWM's Annalise Hensel recently reported on the Milwaukee Police Department's use of actors in the training. They portray people with a mental illness acting out scenarios that police may encounter.
For her story, Annalise asked Laura Usher about the need for crisis intervention education. Usher is Senior Manager for Criminal Justice and Advocacy at NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
We've done some reporting about training Milwaukee police officers are receiving on how to work with people who are in a mental health crisis in order to help provide the assistance that person may need or subdue them if they are acting in a way that could be dangerous to themselves or others. How important is that type of training, and why is it necessary?
It continues to be a huge problem that we have limited mental health services in so many communities and that police are the frontline responders to people in crisis. But CIT programs really provide a moment of hope in what's really a horrible situation for many people, that the worst time in their lives sometimes is this horrible crisis, and it can make a huge difference to have someone compassionate come to you in this moment of crisis and provide assistance and get you to mental health care when you need it versus take you to jail.
So when officers receive training for working with a person who is mentally ill, who is in crisis, what do those officers learn?
Sure. Well, one emphasis of the training is safety for everyone involved, the officer, the individual in crisis, anyone who may be in the situation, the family or bystanders. And the way that we teach safety through the training is by slowing the situation down and creating more time and distance for officers to safely manage a situation. So I'll give you an example. In sort of typical law enforcement training, when an officer sees someone armed with a knife, the instinct is to shout loud commands, maybe have a number of officers close in, sort of surround the individual, shout, drop the knife, drop the knife, drop the knife, really loudly. And that, with a person with a mental illness, is likely to cause the person to become more agitated, to become more upset, to, you know, potentially become violent if they're inclined to. And with CIT training, what we say is take a step back, have one person talk to the individual, because it's going to be easier to communicate with one person rather than multiple different communicators. And, you know, officers are going to speak in the, you know, authoritative voice, but they're not going to shout in a sort of loud, frightening way. They're going to try to create some kind of rapport with the individual when it's safe to, you know, when there is the opportunity to introduce themselves, to ask them to put down any weapon that they have, to find out what's going on with the individual that day, to find out what they can do to help, to resolve the situation, and that creates time to think of options for dealing with the situation as well. And that's the other thing, is officers are often taught to resolve a situation as quickly as possible. And somebody in crisis may be very frustrating to deal with because they're not necessarily what officers signed up to do, to deal with. But part of the CIT training is teaching patients that you have to take some time to deal with it calmly and that you have the support of your agency to take that time, that you don't have to resolve the call as quickly as possible.
Here in Milwaukee, some theater students from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee are acting as a person who's in crisis for the training sessions that law officers go through at the police academy. What do you make of that approach of using actors in this role?
Well, I think it can be very successful to have actors involved in the CIT training. I think one of the most important parts of CIT is what we call the scenario-based training, where the officers get to practice their skills by interacting with actors or volunteers who play the part of someone in crisis, and then they practice their skills trying to de-escalate that situation. So it's incredibly important that they get a chance to practice the skills that they've heard about and then get immediate feedback from their instructors, from their teachers, from the actors that they're interacting with about how did they do, what could they have done differently. And using actors can be a very effective way to do that. As long as the actors are trained and understand the perspective of someone who has a mental illness and can accurately portray that, I think that can be very helpful.
If a police department wants to use this type of approach of using actors to portray somebody who has a mental illness, what sort of training or preparation should they go through in order to do a good job in that role?
Well, I'm not aware of any trainings that provide actors with instruction on how to portray someone with a mental illness. So my suggestion for actors or for programs that would want to portray that accurately would be that the actors need to have some sort of direct experience, either working with individuals who have mental illness or as mental health care providers, as police officers, or that they've spent significant time interacting with, interviewing individuals who have these conditions. Because there are some very sort of stereotypical views of mental illness that you see portrayed on TV or in the media that are not accurate. So I do think the best way is personal interaction with someone who has a mental illness so they can talk about what it's really like and what it's kind of like internally in addition to what you might see externally to help the actors portray, you know, what might be driving that individual as well. And then also it matters how the scenarios are written. The scenario should instruct the actors on what kinds of cues they're looking for from the officers that they're training with, you know, what sorts of things might escalate or de-escalate the situation with that particular individual. And it shouldn't be, an easy calculus that, you know, if the officer says X, you calm down. The officer says Y, you get more upset. But there should be some instruction to the actors about those things.
Laura Usher is Senior Manager for Criminal Justice and Advocacy at NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She talked with WUWM's Annalise Henzel, and you can find more of her reporting on the issue at WUWM.com.
We recently got an update on the work of Milwaukee's Institute for Urban Agriculture and Nutrition. Stick around, that conversation is coming up on Lake Effect right after this short break.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee's Institute for Urban Agriculture and Nutrition began 3 years ago as a conversation between Will Allen, the founder of Growing Power, and then UW-Milwaukee Chancellor Mike Lovell. They envisioned a network of local researchers, educators, and community groups working together to nurture urban agriculture initiatives.
Last July, IUAN became legally designated as a cooperative. And to learn what's next for the group, Susan Benz traveled travel to Heartlove Place on North Martin Luther King Drive, across from a burgeoning garden and community gathering place. Susan spoke with four members of the cooperative. First, Michael Carrier of the Milwaukee School of Engineering explains why the group chose to morph into a cooperative.
I think that idea of stakeholder equity was huge. The idea that if you want to make the point that this is a institute for everyone within the city, the idea that you may have some voting classes at the institutional level, but then you have everyone else, how do you both symbolically but also pragmatically make this a functioning equal relationship? And to us, it was the idea of a cooperative model, which you don't see very often.
And it took some time. It took legal time. It took a lot of community time. It's taken a lot of adjustment on everybody's part to stay and trust the process long enough to let something come out and evolve on the other side.
When you jumped in, were you with Heartlove or was this in a previous life?
I live in this neighborhood. So after 20 years of working in city government and being a resident for that amount of time, so my relationship with Heartlove grew out of my need personally to want to serve the people in the community. Healthy, sustainable families is what Heartlove's primary mission is. So no, I was here, but that I was always here, someplace on this block. So it didn't matter. But the reality is for me is that you don't get social justice if people are not on equal footing.
So has the foundation remained looking at rebuilding, if that's the right word, urban agriculture, and looking at the state of health in the community and how that can, as a consequence, improve as well?
I would say more so enhance what's already going on, because the overall idea of Chewy is to...
Chewy?
Chew on. The overall goal is to enhance what's already going on and to make the work that people are already doing on the ground easier through the steps that academia can help us with. And so I got involved. I was in the original community action group and the committee. I remember equal footing was something that we stressed heavily, and we didn't want this to be something where the residents were the first people left out. And I think this cooperative has done a really good job of honoring just the steps needed to do this right. Because I think we could have got this moved faster, but we would have sold a little bit of our integrity along the way.
What stage are you at now? Are you looking for more members? Are you looking for money? Are you building programs? What's going on?
Yes, yes, and yes. All of those things. I suppose we can start at the baseline, which is the funding piece. The grant from the Growth Agenda program has ended, and we had hoped that that program would continue so that we could continue to pay for operations, but in the governor's budget, that whole grant program was removed. So now we have to look to our membership to do the funding, and that's not an easy task in this environment when all of the academic institutions are hurting for money anyway. But there's a huge interest by the academic institutions to fund this because it's the way that they can do community-based research with the partners. And it's really the only way to translate the knowledge that is our business in the academia to grow knowledge. It's the only way that we can translate it to the community is by having them at the table designing the projects. So in order to get funding, we need more members. So we are recruiting members. Then we can continue to build programs. So the first step on building the programs is the CAC, the Community Action Council, is responsible for coming up with a research agenda that's going to be relevant to all of the partners who are involved.
What has came from sort of my work is a partnership with MATC. They have a dietary technician program, and through that program, we had hosted a series of culturally relevant nutrition courses in communities. So it got the students a chance to step out of the walls of the school, but then it also provided unique opportunities for residents to learn how to make, cauliflower mashed potatoes or sauteed greens. And And just continuing to challenge people to find new options, both on the north and the south side. So it was meeting residents where they are and helping them figure it out there. Because I think sometimes, as these supergroups start, sometimes they want to impose what they want you to do. And I think, well, I know we've done a really good job to not do that and to listen.
It's early for Heart Love to talk about how it can be useful. We're preparing food handlers and cooks and chefs and sous chefs to make them kind of more conscious about what's fresh, how they can build better menus for the population, be they obesity, diabetes, all of those things that our community is tend to be plagued with. So what we're looking at is kind of showing them there's a community garden over there. Are you over there looking at what's in there to help those families in those blocks learn how they can eat better? I'm hearing people say that, oh yeah, you know what, our garden is going to do these, so we're going to do this. So they're starting to have conversations block to block about how they can be more strategic about what's growing so that they can share. We started off with 5 plots across the street, and we have 5 plots in the back, rear of the building. 200 people are eating out, ate out of that garden this summer, the first year out, and that's before the trees are mature enough for the kids to pick them. So people want the fresh stuff. There was no limitation. You didn't have to come work it because the kids are already doing that. So once we told the community it's yours for the taking, it was literally theirs for the taking. And then we're seeing them show up in our culinary classes as to how to cook with it. So we know that as this thing moves forward, there's a lot more education. I think about our arm could easily work with churches and the ladies who are fixing the repasses and who are having the church conferences to say, okay, look, let's make sure that we have enough growing to take care of what we're going to be doing in the community. So I think that if I imagine this 5 or 6 years out, I could really see there be a nice little network like that.
And that's where a school like MSOE can come in. We're already partnering with UNO on a number of projects, but providing the infrastructure mm-hmm. for some of the programming that she's doing. So our next plan is to build an outdoor stage for the park across the street with a demonstration kitchen and a market stand. So the students that go through the culinary training program will have a place to sell their products. So if they want to become entrepreneurs, it's a huge first step to rent out a storefront. But if you give sort of a small space to incubate an idea, it's there. The stage can be demonstration for visiting chefs to come, or programming for the culinary program itself. And so that relationship is perfect. I can provide students that can build things. Right. UNA can provide the programming, under the umbrella of the institute.
We had a student that created something this year called a soul roll. A soul roll is a, what is it, a wonton or a...
like an egg roll?
Egg roll with collard greens and turkey. It is amazing.
Of the 90 gardens that we have, a lot of those groups haven't yet been at the table to express what they're interested in. So there's a ton of possibilities for what we don't even know yet. So I just wanted to throw that out there too. And also that I think this model will work, but Milwaukee as a whole, we need to be aggressive in cultivating that talent there.
Michael?
I think for me, there's often this rush to quantify what we're going to do. But I think what I've gotten out of it so far is the relationships that we've been able to cultivate. So if you take the park across the street, Antoine and Groundwork was involved, UNA was involved, MSOE was involved, Growing Power donated the fruit trees. And so all of these partners that came together initially through Chuan mm-hmm. are doing these projects. Because of the success of that project, we're doing another park adjacent to the Fondy Farmers Market. This idea that the relationships are cultivated begin to allow for these projects to spread quickly. It's hard to quantify if that's job creation or necessarily what that is, but that impetus is there. And I think 5 years down the road, you'll see this as ground zero for a lot of projects that you are able to quantify by that point. But mm-hmm. that initial step is sort of that cultivating those relationships that allow for that work to begin.
We just heard from 4 members of the Cooperative Institute for Urban Agriculture and Nutrition. Bonnie Halverson is the founding executive director of the cooperative. Michael Carrier is the director of the MSOE University Scholars Honors Program. Antoine Carter is the Program Director for Groundwork Milwaukee, and Una Vandeval is the Fund Development Director with Heart Love Place. Their interviews with Susan Bentz first aired in December.
Keep listening. We'll speak with poet and Milwaukee native Jody Hollander about her craft and her upcoming new collection of poems. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Poet Jody Hollander's aim is to make words sing no matter where in the world she's writing them.
Hollander was born and raised in Milwaukee, but for the past two decades, she's been traveling around the world developing her craft. She attended Pomona College in California and then went to the United Kingdom for graduate studies. Since 2007, she's participated in artist residencies and fellowships around the world, including a Fulbright Fellowship in South Africa and stops in Italy, the U.S., the U.K., Australia, and France.
Her first collection of poetry, The Humane Society, was published by a British press in 2012. In April 2017, her latest book is due out, and it's called My Dark Horses.
Lake Effect's Mayon Silver reached Hollander via Skype from Colorado, and Hollander talked about what she thinks makes for a good poem.
There are things you can do to help it move along. Space and time and quiet and reading lots of good poetry can help. But really, the poem will mature when the poem is ready to mature. And too much ambition can actually kill the poem. So I think one of the great lessons that I've learned as a poet is that you have to be willing to follow the lead of the poem and let the poem create itself when it's ready.
One of the things that you write about a lot is your family and your childhood. Would you call your family and your childhood as sort of a muse of your poetry?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was very fortunate to grow up in a family of professional classical musicians. And for a poet, I think that you really couldn't ask for a better groundwork to deal with, because as far as I'm concerned, really the music that one hears within a poem is the most important part of making a good poem. And so growing up in that environment where there was constantly classical music being talked about and played really gave me a background and structure to work with. And then, of course, my family itself, their dynamic was interesting for me as well to write about. I mean, I think it's a unique upbringing in that not many people grow up in these kinds of circumstances. So it really gave me some interesting subject matter to work with as well.
Well, and, you know, the idea that everybody in your family was a musician or a classical musician, and you didn't really take to that so much, right?
That's right, yeah.
So you had to kind of find your own way and feel a little bit like, you know, you were charting new territory, sort of.
Absolutely. I felt like the black sheep for most of my childhood because I wasn't a classical musician. And I think that was actually good for me in terms of the building of a poetic sensibility, because I think that sort of by nature, poets are on the outskirts and they're observers and oftentimes are the black sheep. Of course, as a kid, you just want to fit in and you want to be in the mix and you want to be like everyone else in your family. So it had its challenging moments, but ultimately I think that the recipe was actually perfect for creating a poet.
Well, and one of, you know, everyone can kind of relate to family relationships aren't always perfect. They aren't always easy. And you had, you know, sort of some somewhat tense relationship with your mom during the large swath of your life. So this poem that I want to ask you to read, you have a poem prepared, and I was wondering if you would be willing to read it.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Is there any context to the poem that you want to lay out?
Well, the context is really that I was living abroad at the time over in England, and my mother had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, which is a really ugly diagnosis. And I was home for the holidays trying to help. And I was just sort of asking, what can I do to help? And what my mother wanted was a pair of overalls, actually. And the reason was she was hoping to be still be able to practice the cello, but to have to be able to wear something that could protect her surgery scars. So I was tasked with heading out to Farm and Fleet to buy her a pair of overalls. And I couldn't help but feel that there was an incredible irony that this concert classical cellist was going to be wearing a pair of overalls. And so I came up with this poem, Shopping for Overalls in Milwaukee. I'm looking for a pair of overalls for my mother, something to cover up her surgery scars. But these days, she's getting smaller and smaller, and I wonder if anything here will fit. Can I help you? The store clerk asks. No, I snap. She wouldn't understand. The overalls all seem to hang listlessly like oversized dolls with long legs dragging on the floor and wide asses sagging in the back. So I wander to the children's aisle and slip on a pair. In the mirror, I see my mother looking straight back at me, her sharp nose, her hurting eyes. And I wonder if it's too late to trade my happiness for hers. I buy the overalls anyway and wrap them in a silly bag, wanting to make her smile after chemo. I'll place the overalls near her pillow and hope when she awakens, I can try rolling up the long pants legs, adjusting the long straps on her shoulders, cinching the brass buttons on her waist. Then I'll lift up her bald white body and somehow try and keep her inside.
It's interesting. You could write pages and pages of prose about seeing your mother die of cancer, and maybe these pages of prose would not be as powerful as 26 lines of poetry. What is it about the structure and the form of poetry that fits with you?
Well, I like to think of poetry as somewhere in the middle between prose and music. And so, in my opinion, all good poetry has a really strong musical quality to it. And so for me, if I can make words sing in some capacity, then I'm giving them a different sort of meaning than what the meaning would be if I were to write a story or an article or a prose piece. You can hear a pattern of stresses and non-stresses, which serve to create a music within the line of poetry. There's really something about music that is ear-pleasing, that's attractive, that we love. People love music. So if I can make my words musical, in my mind, I'm creating the most heightened, most emotional experience for the reader to have.
Well, you have a poem that does that really well called Metronome from your first book. It has the musicality that you're talking about, and it draws you into an emotional experience. Can you read that one?
Sure. The Metronome. She set the metronome ticking, her children the pendulum, rocking back and forth from mother to father, father back to mother. Then she'd twist the knob to father, mother, mother, father, or call out allegro and they'd speed up, father, mother, mother, father, father, mother. Her children walked sideways, their eyes shifted horizontally. They looked dizzy, even possessed, missing the cars zooming in front of them. But somehow they always heard mother's tempo and passed from this lover to that lover from that lover to this.
That poem, you not only have the musicality of the syllables and how the words are put together, but there's also music based on the words choices.
Yeah, that's right. I think because, you know, a lot of my childhood was centered around the vocabulary associated with classical music that inevitably would find its way into my poems. And a lot of my poems in the Humane Society and also in My Dark Horses are about being a classical musician. And in some ways, maybe indirectly, are reflective also of what it's like to be a poet.
You write poetically about your childhood or about potentially painful things and the death of your mom and that sort of thing. But yet one thing I know about you is that you don't like the question, is your poetry therapeutic? Can you explain why you don't like that?
Yeah, that's actually a really important question, because I think a lot of people associate poetry and many art forms with catharsis and this idea that, well, if I can write a poem or if I can paint something, I can just get all of my feelings out and then I feel better. Or the sort of sense that writing poetry might be an alternative to going to therapy. And that can be frustrating, I think, for artists to sort of feel like that their art isn't taken as seriously because it's simply reduced to this sort of form of just getting everything out and then feeling better. For me, I like to think of poetry as therapeutic, not in the traditional sense, in the sense that, oh, I got everything out, I feel better, but more in terms of the idea that the poet or the novelist or the writer takes control of all of the characters and all of the events, maybe even changes the facts a little bit, changes them around, and makes the experience their own. And in that way, I think it's therapeutic in terms of the idea that the experience is not something that happened to me, but the experience is now mine and something that I'm in control of.
That's very interesting because, you know, the poetry is art first and foremost, right?
That's right. And, you know, my hope is that I'm reaching people through my words, that I'm not just writing for the sake of writing itself, but writing in order to reach other people. Maybe somebody else has gone through the same experience that I have, or maybe they haven't, but through my poem, they'll go through that experience and they'll experience it not as something difficult and challenging, but as something beautiful and musical because it's a poem now.
Well, so one of the poems from your new book, My Dark Horses, the title poem, would you be able to read that one?
Sure.
And give us a little bit of context as to that, if there's any.
Well, this poem actually was inspired by the very first residency that I did. It was out in rural Australia. And my husband and I were living in Australia at the time. And the only companions I had were two horses. And actually, originally, the poem wasn't about dark horses. It was just about horses. And later, I changed the poem to be about dark horses because I liked the sort of connotations there. Okay, My Dark Horses. If only I were more like my dark horses, I wouldn't have to worry all the time that I was running too little and resting too much. I'd spend my hours grazing in the sunlight and taking long naps in the vast pastures. And when it was time to move along, I'd know. I'd spend some time with all those I'd loved, then disappear into a gathering of trees. If only I were more like my dark horses, I wouldn't be so frightened of the storms. Instead, when the clouds began to gather and fill, I'd make my way calmly to the shed and stand close to all the other horses. Together, we'd let the rain fall around us, knowing as darkness passes overhead that above all, this is the time to be still.
Well, Jody Hollander, I really appreciate you coming and speaking and reading some of your poems, and I hope that you have a lot more muses to come.
Thank you so much for having me.
Poet Jody Hollander is a Milwaukee native. Her newest collection of poems is called My Dark Horses and will be published this spring. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver via Skype from Colorado.
One more break, and then we'll catch up with Wisconsin writer Sandy Brell. The sequel to her middle grade novel set in occupied Norway during World War II is recently out. This is Lake Effect from WUWN. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. It was 3 years ago when we met Wisconsin writer Sandy Brell. Her first novel for middle grade readers was called Odin's Promise and told the story of a young girl coming of age in Norway during the German occupation in World War II. At its heart, the lesson learned by Mari, the young protagonist, is a timeless one, that she's stronger than she thinks she is.
The book has now spawned a sequel. In fact, it'll be a trilogy. The second book, though, is called Bjorn's Gift, and in it, Mari turns 12 as the occupation goes on. Sandy Brell joins us in the Lake Effect studio, along with an auxiliary Lake Effect staffer who also happens to be 12 years old. She will join us in a little bit, but first, Sandy Brell, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's nice to see you, too, and I'm always happy to come to UWM and Lake Effect.
Well, so let me start by, let's talk a little bit about the whole series of works. This is the sequel to Odin's Promise, which we talked about a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And I forget, did you realize at the time that this would be a trilogy?
Not in the least. I had spent so long trying to find my way into the stories that I was trying to tell. And when I finally discovered resources that allowed me to get Mari's voice and Mari as a character, it moved along very quickly and well, and it incorporated the key stories and the history that I was aiming for, and it encompassed a natural story arc in the 1 year, and I was very happy that people read it and enjoyed it. And then, within a few weeks of the time people were reading it, they said, so when does the sequel come out? What sequel? And I had no more stories to tell, but I had a character and I had history, and so I dug into more research and got to work on it.
What made you so interested in that time and that place?
Well, I've always had an interest in World War II, and particularly in Europe, because my dad was a soldier there. And But what brought this story on is that I had traveled with a friend to Norway. I am not Norwegian, but she is the only child of an immigrant who was the only one in his family to move here. And after he had died and she wanted to go meet her family members, she wanted someone to travel with. So I had the opportunity to visit there twice. And in her fulfilling her purposes, she was meeting people who had been young adults at the time of the war, the long 5-year occupation. And I was sure that Norway had been neutral the way Sweden was or Switzerland was. And it turns out that wasn't the case at all. And their stories just were so embedded with national pride and resilience and humor. The humor particularly struck me, and I came away knowing that I'd want to write those stories. However, after many, many years, I wasn't finding a way to do it to reach the right audience. So,
well, and so can you set the scene for people who did not know the first book? Mari is our young hero, though mm-hmm. she might not realize that she's mm-hmm. a hero. The books are, as you say, set in Norway. But can you give us a sense for where Mari is metaphorically anyway as this new book opens?
Well, she's living in the same village in Itre Arne, which is a tiny little district village on the backside of the mountains near Bergen. And that's kind of metaphorical for her life. It's been a very sheltered, protected life. She is 10 years younger than her older siblings when the first book begins, and it encompasses that 1 year in which she does a lot of growing up and recognizing more of her potential to have agency in the world. The start of this book is August of the following year, after a full year of occupation, and it encompasses the year and a half in which it leads up to the start of 1943. I started out aiming for a sequel, which would have been one book, taking an 11-year-old and turning her into a 16-year-old, and also encompassing the research that I was finding, and it would have been a Harry Potter book, and it wasn't appropriate. And so with my editor's help, we talked about turning it into a two-part stage, because in that year and a half, enormous numbers of things changed within the context of the occupation.
Right, and for much of the book, she is 12, mm-hmm. which can be a tricky age at any time in history, but being a 12-year-old in World War II occupied Norway is especially not easy.
Extremely. And each piece, she was shaped as much by the information that kept coming toward her as anything. Early in the first book, her neighbor from right across the road, a Jewish man, is arrested in front of her eyes. And that is a minor theme in the first book. In the next year, and the Germans also have come in claiming to be Aryan brothers, Viking brothers, one spirit, one people. They were there to protect them from the Allies. And by the second book, that facade is dropping away. And they are
clearly occupiers.
They're clearly occupiers, and they're clearly frustrated that not many people are buying their pitch. And so Mari had already become aware of that, as most people had. But the intensity of implementing laws and imposing laws, and in fact, the Jewish arrests and deportations take place in that time frame. So it's a significant amount of it's a transitional year for her from just being a braver little girl to becoming a real younger teen.
Well, so as we said, she is 12, and now we were both 12 at some point in our lives. But I thought it might be useful to bring an actual 12-year-old along who has read these books and might have some questions and observations that neither of us might have thought of. She was fairly easy to book because she is my daughter. Sylvie, hello.
Hi.
So, Sylvie, before I turn the microphone over to you to ask any questions, let me ask you, did you think Mari was a pretty convincing 12-year-old?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's more difficult for her since it's wartime, but she still goes through a lot of the same things that, I mean, I'm going through and a lot of other people go through at that time. Because, I mean, there's already so many changes that are happening, but to add on war to that.
Did it get you to thinking about what it must have been like for someone your age to go through this?
Yeah. I mean, it made me think a lot more about what they had to go through. I mean, it made my life even a little bit easier because I knew that I wasn't going through war, but yeah.
Well, so did you have any questions for Sandy Brell?
So my question was, why did you choose to do like a 12-year-old and not somebody older or younger than that?
Well, you really hit on the biggest problem that I had writing these books, which is that all the people that I heard from at the start of the war were somewhere between 18 or 20, 22, and then lived into their early 20s over the 5 years. And that's the story I kept trying to tell. But that would be fine if I'd wanted to write an adult novel, but I was really still picturing the students that I had taught and the students that I loved sharing books with. But a young person doesn't want to read an entire book about adults where they want to see themselves in it. So it was when I did my research in which Kathleen Stoker, who wrote a book about humor fighting the Nazis in Norway, and she incorporated journal entries written by people who were 10, 11, and 12, and some older. And keeping a journal was a huge risk to the person and to their family because the Germans searched everything on a regular basis. But in reading those, it was as if Mari just came into the room with me and said, see, that's what I was thinking while you were trying to tell all that other stuff. That's how I would see it. And in doing that, I was able to just, I had done the research, I had been writing the stories, and now Mari took them over. But she really took over. She, all the way through, has been turning what I was after in her own direction to make sure it was telling it from her point of view, which I appreciate very much. I feel like she's my best writing coach now.
Well, and there are journal entries. I don't think it's giving anything away, but
no.
They don't comprise the entire book, but we do see some of Mari's journal entries, mm-hmm. which are written as letters to her brother, who mm-hmm. is fighting in the resistance.
Right. At the end of the first book, her much older brother, in his early 20s, has reached the point he has to leave and join the mountain fighters. And she is really on her own in many ways, in part thinking as a 12-year-old, too. She's always struggled since the Germans came at knowing who she could trust, having come from a life in which she trusted everyone. But in this book, she is really at that age where people you thought were your friends your whole life start acting differently, and you wonder if you've changed, if they've changed, if they're the same person. How could someone you thought this about be doing that? So she begins to work out a lot of her feelings by keeping a notebook, which, again, is in tribute to the journal writers that I read about in the research, that many people were brave enough to do that. It also allows me to switch from the point of view. The way it's written is, it's called close third person or third person close. So I'm writing as if I'm in Mari's head, but I'm not saying I all the way through it. Instead, it is that she and she, but it's we're really reading her thoughts. But in the journal, she gets to switch over to first person and speak in her own voice. And I really enjoyed doing that, too. Plus, it allowed me to move more time ahead without making it Harry Potter.
And then I don't know how much of a professional question this is going to be.
Go for
but
it.
Was it fun making up, like, the Nazis, like the bad guys in the story?
Well, it was a lot of my information about the way they lived and what they did came directly from research. What I enjoyed doing was trying to make sure that there were no caricatures, that they were true characters. So while you could have someone, say you put a Nazi uniform on, you know what they're going to act like, you know what they're going to think like, I tried to allow Mari to be confronted in both books, and it will continue in the third, that recognizing that you can't ever make assumptions about why people are doing what they're doing. You can judge their actions, but it's not fair to say they did that because they are evil. So yes, I enjoyed very much trying to make those characters fully developed as much as they could be for being secondary in the story.
Well, right. One of the trickiest parts of Mari's life as this second book plays out is how she relates to the people of her own little town, mm-hmm. some of whom have made these compromises mm-hmm. to get through the Nazi occupation.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about her complicated feelings about Leif, who is one of her peers?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, we should have her here. She she had gone the elementary schools in Norway then and for the most part now. You'd start in first grade with one teacher, and you and your cohort, your group of students, classmates, stay together with that teacher through 6 years. So they move right up together. And then after that basic school is done, then you move into a secondary school in which you switch from class to class, and more schools come together to share that space. So Mari had been with her classmates for 6 years and thought she knew these people, even though she had been shy. And in fact, when the Unghird, which is the youth version of Hitler's highest guards, his elite military corps, was formed to support young trainees from age 14 up. So Leif, all of a sudden, is joining this group. And there were many pressures to join, but he was gung-ho. And so every time she turned around, he'd do something that infuriated her. And then later on, he'd do something that made her wonder about it. And she tried asking trusted adults, and she tried confronting him. And throughout it, in fact, it's such a controversy for her that I end up with two chapters. One chapter is friend or foe, and then later on it's friend or foe again because he truly confuses her a lot.
And Sylvie, you're not in a war, but I mean, this has to be kind of familiar to you, just mm-hmm. how people change that you've known for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, there's friends who I've had in elementary school, and then either they change or I've changed, and then I'm not really friends with them anymore, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have to be an enemy.
Yeah.
But in her case, if you choose up sides, it pretty much makes you the enemy. But
yeah,
it's not an uncommon thing for any 12-year-old or 11-year-old or 13-year-old to see that things aren't what they seem.
Well, and along those lines, it must be kind of a luxury to be able to create a character like Mari and have her essentially grow up over the course of these books.
Well, the first luxury was that I tried so hard to find her for so many years that when I was hearing from readers that they wanted a sequel, we have to know what happened to Mari. We care too much about Mari. And I was dancing a happy dance around my house for that. So it was really very interesting to not only help her grow through all the history that evolved, but also have her help me decide the best ways for that to be authentic and also to let her be both the typical child and live in very atypical circumstances. So, yes, it really has been.
Sylvie, did you have any other questions?
Was it easier writing about, in the head of, a girl than a boy? Or do you think it would have been the same?
Well, I'm sure it's not the same. Well, I bet you would guess it's not the same.
I'm pretty sure it's not the same.
It's not the same. But interestingly enough, when I got the first book done, I was sending it out and seeing if I could get it published, and I started working on a middle grade book with a male character, a boy character. And I was moving along on that pretty well, but this whole thing has been snowballing to the point that his name is Joe, and he's a contemporary boy, like in a middle school that you would attend, modern day. And he just every once in a while calls to me and says, "Are you ever coming back?" Yes, I'll get there, Joe. Relax. And it's really quite different. But I enjoy the historic stories and the contemporary stories, and I write picture book texts and all kinds of things. Each one, you're a reader, you know. We were talking before we began. If a book really is telling a story well or doing its job, whatever is in the world of that book takes you over. And by the time you get to the last page, if you've stayed that long and loved it, then it did a good job. And as a writer, that same thing is true. If I'm floundering around and not finding my way through something, then it's better to set it aside and work on something else. If it's got to come to life for me.
Well, Sandy Brell, thank you so much. I know we certainly enjoyed being immersed in that world, and looking forward to book number 3 when it comes out.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being invited back, and I really am happy to be able to meet Sylvie. And
Sylvie, thanks for the assist.
Thanks. You're welcome. Sorry.
You can just say you're welcome.
You're welcome.
Wisconsin writer Sandy Brell's latest book for middle grade readers is called Bjorn's Gift and is the sequel to Odin's Promise. You can find a link to more about her at WUWM.com. And thanks again to Auxiliary Lake Effect staffer and future radio host Sylvie Tyke for putting her interview skills to use. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.